Well, thanks everybody for getting back so promptly since we broke a little bit late for lunch. I appreciate your efforts to get back here timely. As mentioned earlier this morning, COSO has begun an effort to update their framework, integrated framework for internal control. And we're fortunate to have Dave Landsettel and Miles Everson, who are working on the project, Dave being the chairman of COSO. And Lou Ferguson and Keith Wilson are going to lead the discussion from the PCOB's perspective. And Lou, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Marty. Dave Landsettel is here today from the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations of the Treadway Commission, I think much more familiarly known as COSO, to provide an overview of their project to modernize the COSO Internal Control Integrated Framework, first developed in 1992. The purpose of the project is to make the existing framework more relevant to today's complex global business environment so that organizations worldwide can better design, implement, and assess internal control. Auditors are required to consider internal controls as part of all audits, and in integrated audits, auditors must express an opinion on the effectiveness of internal control over financial reporting. For integrated audits, the PCOB standards state that auditors should use the same internal control framework as management does in its assessments. When the auditors or company managements perform an evaluation of internal control over financial reporting, they look, for the most part, to established control frameworks for the criteria to use in making that evaluation. And although the PCOB standards and the SEC rules don't specify a particular control framework to use, in the U.S., the internal control framework that's probably most widely used by public companies and their auditors is the COSO Internal Control Integrated Framework. So an update of that framework is a very welcome development. Now, after Dave's presentation, SAG members will have an opportunity to ask questions and discuss potential implications of these changes in audits. Along with Dave, Miles Everson of PwC, who's on the project team, is here to help answer questions. So I'm going to turn this back over to Keith Wilson and let him introduce Dave and Miles.
Well, I think the introductions have already taken place, so I will just move along. Dave has some slides that are in your materials here today, and he's going to go through, provide an overview of the project, and we're going to then open up for questions, comments to them or to other views of the SAG members on this subject related to this. So, Dave.
Oh, there we go. A little delayed reaction, but thank you, Keith. And Miles and I are delighted to be here today to chat with you. I think the timing's excellent from our standpoint because we're at a stage in our project that not only will we be providing information to you, but we'll be anxious to get comments that'll be input from you that'll be important to us going forward. So we're delighted to be here. Let's see. You did get copies of the slides ahead of time, and I'm not going to have time to go over all the material that's on the slides, but importantly, I want to comment on four areas. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about COSO, just so everybody's on the same page as to our organization. Then I want to talk about the overall objectives, governance, and timetable of our project. Update you a little bit on content changes that are anticipated and structural approaches that we are looking at, and finally, a discussion of potential impact on governance principles, fraud deterrence, and SOX 404. So COSO was formed in 1985 initially to sponsor what is widely known as the Treadway Commission, National Commission on Fraudulent Financial Reporting. A couple things about COSO. It's a voluntary private sector organization with five sponsors, and they've been the same five sponsors since 1985, the American Accounting Association, the AICPA, the FEI, the Institute of Management Accountants, and the Institute of Internal Auditors. The combined membership of those five organizations worldwide is about 500,000, half a million people. So we have good support behind us in terms of our sponsoring organizations. The board members include a representative from each of the sponsoring organizations, as you can see here, Larry Rittenberg, the former chair, and myself. Three of the five organizations, the representative is the CEO of that organization. Those are the last three. And in all cases, they're individuals that command respect and are high enough in the organization that they can speak effectively for the mission and provide guidance. And I'll add, I've been chair for 18 months, and I really think it's an outstanding board. So that's a big plus from my standpoint. And our mission is to provide thought leadership, a think tank, so to speak, dealing with three interrelated subjects, and those are enterprise risk management, ERM, internal control, and fraud deterrence. Having said that, it's important to note that we're not a lobbying group, and we're not a standard-setting group. We look to provide thought leadership on these issues, and others have other responsibilities that deal with standard setting. The products that we've put out over the 20-some years of our existence, 20 years of our existence, include two frameworks, one the internal control framework that we're talking about today and updating, and secondly, an ERM framework that was published in 2004. And this timeline that I've provided shows those documents and also some other materials that we've provided that really extend the thinking that's in those basic frameworks, plus two important research studies that we've sponsored that deal with fraudulent financial reporting. And incidentally, Joe Carcello, who's on the SAG group, is a representative, a co-author of those two fraudulent financial reporting research studies. And most recently, we've published a series of thought papers that we'll continue to deal with, that deal with application of risk management ERM materials in the current environment. So let's look at the project objectives, governance, and timetable. I think Lou articulated the project objectives as well as better than I could. We have a goal to upgrade the framework. We believe that the five underlying components of the framework are more or less timeless and have worked effectively over the years, but the context in the guidance in which those five components exist, it really needs updating. For example, technology, think about 1992, technology didn't include the internet, email, manners of communication are drastically affected, and governance has progressed significantly since that time. So the objective is not to fundamentally change the five components that we think are operating effectively, but to really work on the underlying support for those components that provide a context that's important for the effectiveness of the material. In terms of our own governance, the COSO board has, of course, overall responsibility for this project. We are assisted, importantly, first by PricewaterhouseCoopers, who are making a very significant contribution pro bono in assisting us. Coopers and Lybrants, a predecessor firm of PwC, had a similar role back in the original framework in 1990, 91, and 92, and as part of that agreement, there was a right of first refusal in terms of their any updates, and so Pricewaterhouse was very pleased to accept that and help us out in terms of the project team for this project. I'm very pleased with the project team that Miles has put together and the PricewaterhouseCoopers support. It's going to be very critical to us and very helpful to us. We have an advisory council that's a sounding board to us, and that's very important to the effectiveness of our governance and organization. The advisory council has met two times already, and again, I'm very pleased with the effectiveness of that organization. It works well as a sounding board and has already given us some guidance that's very, very valuable. Our timetable and project plan is outlined in more detail on this schedule than I will go over, but in effect, we've gone through the September to January area where we've done the planning for the project and importantly designed a survey and issued a survey instrument that was important to us getting responses from our stakeholders with respect to that would be relevant to our project, and I'll have a slide on that in a few minutes. The current period, beginning in February and extending through August, is digesting the results of the survey, getting other input, and developing drafts of the material. And so at this point in time, we're in the very early stage of the drafts and also dealing with the structure of the material. And then later on in the year, in the September-December timeframe, we'll go out for public exposure with a 90-day exposure period. And then in the first 6 months of 2012, hope to digest the results of the exposure and develop a final document. Next, I'd like to talk about a little bit about the areas of update in terms of content and also about the document structure. And before I do that, though, I want to interject a little bit about the survey that I mentioned. It was a robust survey that we got 653 responses by the deadline date, which was the end of January. Interestingly, we then concluded to leave the survey open through our website so we can continue on an ongoing basis to get information and use that as one means of getting additional information. But the 653 responses were very pleased. I want to say thorough, robust, thoughtful responses from a broad base of our stakeholders that included large and small companies, not-for-profit organizations. As it says here on the slide, 27% were international, which is important to us. And one overall result, which was consistent with our anecdotal information, was that a large majority of the respondents support updating, but not a major overhaul of the framework. In other words, the approach we're taking where we presume the components are timeless and won't change, but really get the underlying support for those components need to be changed, is consistent with the survey results that we got. So I've listed on this slide and the next slide that you have in your packet a number of areas that we envision will be affected by the update, and I don't want to, in the interest of time, go over all of these areas, but let me real briefly talk about three or four of them. First of all, number one, the increased use of technology and implications from new technology is a very obvious one. If you think back of where we were in 1992 compared to where we are today, not just with the internet and email, et cetera, but now cloud computing, et cetera. I mean, there's lots of IT changes and changes in the environment from that perspective that are important to us. So that's a very obvious area that needs updating. Similarly, number three deals with anti-fraud expectations, which have been enhanced since 1992, and the knowledge of what constitutes good anti-fraud programs has really been given some thoughtful leadership since 1992. So another area that I think is an obvious one that we'll focus on during the revision. Number five, dealing with risk. Obviously, in the last 5 or 10 years, enterprise risk management, risk assessment has become exceedingly visible. And you know, risk assessment is one of our components. So we're anxious to make that more robust in terms of the guidance that we can provide in that area. And interestingly, focusing not just on financial reporting, and I'll mention this because I didn't mention it earlier, but the objectives of the framework extend not just to financial reporting. Financial reporting is relevant under 404, but the objectives of the framework extend to compliance and operational controls as well. And we think we have a real opportunity to make the guidance as it relates to compliance objectives and operational objectives more robust. And so that's an overall interest we have, and it's reflected, I think, in the risk area particularly. And then if you move on to one more that I'll mention, and that's item 9. And again, during the question and answer period, I can certainly be happy to answer questions. Miles and I will on the others. I just don't want to take the time now. But the initial guidance I would describe as principles-based. This guidance that we're developing is also principle-based, with the principles are intended to be outlined more explicitly. And let me, as an aside, in 2006, we put out a publication that applied the original framework in a small business environment, and that publication really articulated some of the framework in a specific principles-based listing of the principles, and we think that's been well accepted, and so we want to, in effect, use that concept in the revision of the guidance. And so in addition to the five components, there will be principles underneath each of those components that will need to presumably be met for a control process to be deemed to be effective. In terms of the document structure, we now believe that there'll be two products at the end of our work, and this is just a recent development that interestingly came out of the last advisory council meeting. At that meeting, we talked quite a bit about a number of issues, but one that created a little tension was one of some individuals on the advisory council being very, very anxious for the document to be more robust, particularly as it relates to compliance and operational objectives, and others on the advisory council wanting to make sure that the path for application of the guidance in a financial reporting arena doesn't become, as one individual said, convoluted. And so there was a little of that tension that we wanted, on the one hand, to expand the document in areas that went beyond what would be relevant at all to 404, for example, and at the same time wanted to preserve the application of the guidance under 404. So what we've concluded is that we'll have two products. One will be an update of the overall framework, which will supersede the 92 document, and another would be a separate document that's the application of the guidance to the financial reporting objective. Now, that financial reporting objective is consistent with 404, but it could be applied certainly beyond what would be required in 404. but it allows us then to have the overall framework be as robust as we think appropriate, and at the same time assure that we have a clear path in the second document for those that only are applying the framework in a financial reporting arena. So that's a conclusion that we more recently formulated, and again, in part after the last advisory committee council meeting. And I might add that after each advisory council meeting, our COSO board meets, and you know, in fact, the very next day, and absorbs the guidance and talks about what the issues are and what kind of guidance we got, and this, you know, was formulated in the board discussion following the council meeting that recently took place. As I alluded to earlier, the document structure will focus on principles explicitly articulated, 20-plus principles in total, extending over the five components. So in other words, for each of the five components, we'll have a specific set of principles that will support those components. And then in the discussion following in the chapter on each of the in each chapter on the five components would be what we'll call attributes, which support the principles. So we kind of have that kind of top-down thought process in terms of the structure of the document. Keith asked me in the discussion before today to provide any comments that we could provide on the impact of the document that the update that we envision as it relates to governance, fraud deterrence, SOX 404, including transition. Let me say it's early in our project, so it's somewhat of a conjecture and hard for us to really, in a definitive way, outline the impact, but we're optimistic that, for example, in terms of governance, that the impact will be a positive one. There's been a lot of development since 1992 that involve the responsibilities of the board, audit committee, compensation committee, and I think for us to recognize that material will provide better guidance to boards and those committees of boards in fulfilling their oversight responsibility. And in terms of understanding, hopefully, what is involved in good guidance as it relates to internal controls. Similarly, in the area of fraud deterrence, I want to say transparency of putting the additional guidance that we believe we can put in the document, the overall framework that deals with the robustness of anti-fraud programs and what we've learned up through today as compared to 1992, and having that be articulated in support of the components in the framework will be helpful in terms of providing a better understanding to what constitutes good anti-fraud programs that are supporting a fraud deterrence objective. We'd very anxious to get your input on those two issues as well. In terms of the impact on 404, I think we'll be able to first say that the fundamental components have not changed, and so on an overall basis, the 404 objectives and focus on components will not change. But we do believe that with the articulation of principles, particularly that there'll be more guidance that will be helpful in the carrying out of the implementation of 404 by affected enterprises. So, for example, if we have 20 principles and a conclusion that presumably those principles are relevant to any overall conclusion as to the effectiveness of internal control, then that gives us a little more concrete area for management to follow in terms of determination as to an effective control system and those that attest to it to a determination as to when a control system is effective and when there are shortcomings, weaknesses that need to be focused on. So that concludes my opening comments. Keith, Miles, and I are just anxious not only to get your questions but to get your input because this is a nice time in the project that we need that input. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. We'll open this up for comments and questions and give Miles and Dave a chance to respond. Start with Jim Cox.
As we're all aware, on a Dodd-Frank carved out 60% of the reporting companies out of 404 last summer. And so when that happened, I was sort of curious of who are these people. And so I went out and started reading what literature I could find, studies, et cetera. And I'm not going to summarize that now. It's on a paper that's already out there on the web. And kind of summarize it very briefly and say that the reporting practices for those companies that were carved out is just a mess. And it's that's charitable. More likely it's misleading. And a lot of evidence that the mess and the misleadingness is designed to or facilitates a lot of overreaching conduct. That shouldn't be surprising. I mean, earlier COSO studies showed that most of the abuses with fraudulent financial reporting and SEC enforcement actions are disproportionately, I mean, they're disproportionately smaller issuers. So that said, I wonder if you might not want to consider, as you go down the road and start thinking about the objectives of this, whether you want to have some sort of divide among those your focus of those companies that are subject to 404 and the auditor's attestation to internal controls and those who are now exempt out of 404, and doing that maybe even somewhat more broadly. As you know, that Congress and Dodd-Frank has also invited the SEC to consider whether others should be also exempted, so the number would even go up above 60%. So as to give some thought to that, maybe whatever you think about in terms of internal controls and practices and governance practices could be shaped in part by whether there's a formal attestation process on internal controls or not, okay? So to make that not just an observation, I guess I would ask, is that something you think you would want to consider?
We haven't considered. You know, we want to be careful that, you know, we're not the regulator and we don't want to make value judgments in terms of we'll make a value judgment that internal control is very important to the success of enterprises. But we don't like to. We don't think COSO's objective is to make a value judgment in terms of whether SOX is a good thing or not. I mean, I think it is, but that's not a COSO position. But we hadn't really thought about, or Miles, you may have. I haven't thought about whether or not we can comment on attestation in a way that would support what you're saying.
No, actually, I think you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm saying as you're going forward and you're thinking a little bit about what your objectives are, do those objectives get shaped by the real-world considerations that some firms are not subject to attestation? I'm not asking you to make a value judgment about whether attestation is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm asking you to look at the world as it exists, which is that some firms are carved out of the attestation function and that has an impact.
Okay, good. And it's consistent with the fact that, you know, we do have a separate financial reporting document, so it fits into that arena. Miles, do you have any comments?
Well, the only comment I would add on this is that the core internal control framework is really written, and the update is intending to be for all companies, whether they have an obligation to report externally or have an attestation done on their assertion or not, so that it's relevant to those that don't have an obligation to report, just as it is to those that do.
I'll just point out that the evidence indicates that that the governance matters in terms of whether there is reliable reporting for firms that are small firms. And so to the extent that you mentioned earlier in your roadmap that you're looking at various governance structures and processes, my suggestion would be with those firms that don't have the overlapping attest function by the independent auditor, perhaps you would give some thought to what the governance structure would be to maybe fill in that gap.
Yeah, in effect, what are the implications of not having that attestation requirement? Yeah, no, it's a good thought, and we just really haven't directly focused on that.
Okay, Scott Showalter.
Thank you. I have a question, actually. When you were going through on slide 38, which is the areas to update, you actually skipped the second one, which was incorporate lessons learned from SOX and the cost of benefit considerations. I don't know if you got to that when you were concluding in your possible, but I'd be interested in what did you hear? What were the lessons learned that may have other impact that isn't disclosed in your last couple slides? Were there other things that we should be aware of that came back on the survey?
Do you want me to take that?
Yeah, do you recall in the survey what...
I don't recall the individual specific responses in the survey here. What I would say is that some of the feedback that we got as it related to 404 was, I'll say, creating greater clarity around the role of the control environment versus kind of the view of the level of reliance that's been put around the control activities side was one point. And then secondarily, fair bit of comments around the role of the monitoring component and what constitutes appropriate monitoring for 404 purposes. And so those comments came back both, and the reason I can't distinguish is I'm getting comments directly from individuals as well as from the survey, but those are two common factors that come back to us, because I think there's a general sense that there's too much emphasis at times and reliance on just the control activities component. And so how do the other components take more prominence in evaluating the total system of control?
Joe Carcello.
Dave, a couple of comments. One, let me piggyback on what Jim Cox said. Although there's no longer a auditor involvement for companies with a market cap below $75 million, as Jim knows, I'm sure, there's still a 404A requirement that management has to issue an opinion on internal control without the auditor's involvement. So I think to the extent that you can make the document more specific, particularly reflecting really all of the governance changes that SOX brought into play, which are many, will be helpful. And I think it'll be helpful because right now, the specificity around management's reporting is pretty wide. So I think to the extent that you can tighten it through a more specific framework will probably be helpful. The other thing I would encourage you to do, Dave, and I've probably touched base on with some of this with you in the past, is there's actually quite a bit beyond SOX and beyond the exchange listing standards. There's actually a lot of learning that's taken place as a result of studies that have happened in the last 10 years, and I'll just hit a couple of areas in the interest of time. One is 407. If you go back and you look at the legislative history there, the Congress had originally written the law, not the Congress, the SEC had initially drafted the rule that would have defined an accounting expert pretty narrowly. And then the business community got a little upset, to put it mildly, and they defined an accounting expert so that, let's just say, quite broadly, and I think I'm being generous. There's an extremely large literature, Dave, probably close to a dozen papers, and almost all of them find that having an accounting expert is much more effective than having a financial expert who meets this more broad definition. So that's one thing I would encourage you to at least consider. The other thing is around independence of the audit committee. And as a result of SOX and exchange listing standards, theoretically, all audit committees are independent, and they typically are looked at in terms of family ties and economic ties. But as you well know, if I want to drive around that, there are a lot of ways to drive around that. Social ties are not really addressed. And I have a paper that I've referred to in the past with Zovana Palmrose and Terry Neal and Sue Schultz, where we look at the role of the governance committee on how people get on the board in the first place. And when the CEO is more involved in that process, any benefit of the audit committee as it relates to non-GAAP reporting that results in restatements is completely gone. It's not weakened. It's gone. And when the audit committee members get on the board with less involvement from the CEO, then non-GAAP-related restatements are significantly less likely. And we cite that in the COSO study that we just came out with. We cite that paper. And I've talked to you about that paper in the past. But so in addition to those, obviously there's a lot of other stuff out there. So I hope you and PwC and the advisory team considers all that.
Joe, they're excellent comments, and we probably need to talk offline to make sure I didn't miss some of your points here, because particularly in terms of the research that's available to us, which is important, because one of the results of Joe's recent study of looking at enforcement releases for 10 years ending 2007 was that some of the more objective, concrete kinds of attributes that typically have been focused on as part of importance in good governance from an effectiveness of the board, there was really no difference between those attributes for companies that there was no fraudulent financial reporting as compared with those companies where there was fraudulent financial reporting. You know, they were no longer discriminating. You know, in other words, both have independent directors on their audit committee, because that's now a requirement, and both have audit committee financial experts, and so to look to other kinds of variables that help discriminate what makes good governance in terms of board effectiveness and what doesn't is very important to us. And some of them, like the one that you says, who makes the appointment of who's on the board, you know, is very interesting to it. And obviously some of these are, I want to say, more softer kinds of elements that are more behavioral in nature and not as easy to measure. But Joe, I think you raise an important issue, and I think you'll be helpful to us in pointing the way to guidance that we could use in our revised framework.
Jim Doty.
Sitting here thinking about the database you have and the $75 million threshold and the fraud connection, to what extent can you find information that would help the board in directing auditors, either in audit practice alerts or in standards relating to communications with audit committees or related statements that enable us better to direct the audit profession in looking for fraud in the issuer that is a sub-$250 or sub-$75 million company? We've talked about the information that ORA is furnishing to FASB. It's the same kind of notion. Can't we get some free and reliable technical assistance here in terms of what you think, where you think the kind of gaps that Jim Cox is talking about crop up in the specific control area?
I think, again, Joe Carcello's study includes some insights that are helpful, and we have actually a separate project that tries to extend that. That's just in the early stages, but your comments are well stated and so noted, and we should try to focus on where we can make more robust the guidance in this area.
Doug Carmichael.
I have a few suggestions. I'm not suggesting that you have, but I think it's important that you not lose sight of the fact that although COSO is not a regulator, it is effectively the setter of internal control standards, and that those standards play a vital public interest role through the SOX 404 requirements. I understand why you want to have a separate discussion of financial reporting, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. But I think it's very important to recognize that compliance and operational objectives very often have financial reporting implications. So I think it's important if you separate them to do extra effort to make sure that people recognize that, that compliance and operational objectives do affect financial reporting. I think an outstanding example in the current financial crisis was, New Century Financial, where they had operational control deficiencies related to not tracking their repurchase claims. And actually, they missed in their repurchase calculation a huge backlog of claims because of that operational control deficiency. The other suggestion relates to estimates. We had some discussion at a past SAG meeting about the importance of having a formal documented methodology for estimates and formal documentation of the connection between the number companies arrive at for an estimate and that documented methodology, the process. And it would be helpful for the COSO framework to cover that.
Okay. Well, with respect to the second, I hadn't focused on it. In other words, what you're saying is, as an internal control measure, you have a methodology that can be relied upon to add assurance that your judgments and estimates are reasonable.
Yeah, and formal documentation of that is necessary to really make sure that it exists. You'll hear all the time, well, we have controls, we have methodology, they're just not documented. Yeah. But that usually means they're not effective either.
Yeah. And the first point you made, we did touch upon at our advisory council meeting. And it's an important issue that we haven't, maybe Miles has solved this problem, but we haven't. It's where at 40,000 feet, I can casually say, you know, we'll split out an application from financial reporting, and don't get in more detail as to how that works. But at the advisory council meeting, that very point was made up that it's not so simple as you might think because of some of the compliance and operational material that we had that would have an effect on financial reporting. So that point was brought up in an advisory council meeting. And, you know, we have the three principles, I know, that kind of are at this point separate and how we get them to interrelate and show that the compliance and operational have implications on financial reporting is important to us. So it's a very good point. And Miles, you can add to that.
I think an important distinction here is when we talk about the two documents, the first document is the integrated framework of internal control and includes all of the objective categories. The second document we're talking about is guidance as to how you think about the application of that framework when reporting on financial or on controls over financial reporting. So we're not bifurcating the framework because that's the core document that the companies assert against and auditors attest against. We believe that needs to stay intact and consider all three categories of objectives. I think the point I'm hearing from you, Doug, is let's make sure that we emphasize the importance of the operational and compliance objectives and controls, really, when concluding on the financial reporting objective. Yeah. Thanks.
I'd like to build on that just for a second, if I can, because I think what Doug's brought out is a very important point. And I think of it in the context of the financial crisis. obviously there's three components of COSO, and we spend a lot of time talking about the internal controls of a financial reporting and 404A and 404B. But the other components, compliance, controls, and particularly I want to talk about operational controls, and I think, Doug, you've heard me say that. Dave, you heard me say this before. Lots of causes of the financial crisis, but maybe one of the greatest causes was companies, financial institutions that advertised or thought they had world-class risk management who maybe didn't understand their risks, first of all, at all, and maybe didn't or appropriately, and didn't have risk management. So there are, within COSO, operational controls over risk management. And I guess my question would be, as you think about the original framework, did you think there were deficiencies in that aspect of the operational controls over risk management that, had they been stronger, maybe companies would have had greater risk management? Or maybe because internal controls over financial reporting are subject to auditor review and reporting, whereas operational controls are not, were those operational controls like risk management subject to auditor review? Might that have a greater impact in terms of having better risk management controls being tested, so on and so forth, to either prevent the next crisis that might be coming down the pike? So maybe I can get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, just as a little background, Miles and I met very early on with Marty and Keith, and I remember you made a very similar point at that time that has really, frankly, been very influential in our mind, and that is, you know, the whole notion that one of the real opportunities we have for benefit of the refresh, the update, is in the operational area, in compliance area, too. And to not lose sight of that and not get so narrowly focused that we think all the time about financial reporting and 404, but really to think, well, are there implications from the financial crisis or otherwise that we really can provide benefits in terms of guidance in the control area that focus on compliance and operational? And your earlier comments were very influential to us. You know, for example, in the discussion at the most recent advisory council meeting where, you know, we want to not forget about compliance and operational and how that works.
Okay, we're going to go to Mary Hartman Morris, who's joining us by phone.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, or actually a couple of statements and then questions. Again, thank you, Dave and Miles, for this. I think it's really important for investors that the COSO framework be continued and upgraded. I think that I want to echo some of the comments made by Jim, Joe, Doug, Marty, you know, the importance of, you know, from the investor's perspective on really strengthening the issues on governance and risk. And I think as a CalPERS, as a financial institutional investor, you know, we did see where there were some great concerns and some issues there. I think we're, this is more a statement than anything else about, of course, the carve-outs on the 404. I think investors lost out when, of course, that changed, although we still appreciate that management still has to make an opinion on that. My question really is, since CalPERS is becoming more global, my question is on one of the areas that I saw that was picked up was about reducing the centric preparation or perception, excuse me. I wanted to know how you're going to be doing that and how are you going to expand on that. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
I apologize, but the last part, U.S.-centric. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the U.S. I caught the centric part of it, but not the U.S., sorry. A very good question. We have two people on the advisory council who are their roots are outside the United States. One is through IFAC, and another is a representative from Switzerland, interestingly not. And they have already been very helpful to us in providing a perspective that we need to be sensitive to in terms of not inadvertently having the guidance written in such a manner that people outside the United States will say, well, this is, you know, American. This isn't something that's helpful to us. And you know, it doesn't extend to a desire of our part, for example, to feel obligated to fully harmonize our guidance with other models that exist outside the United States. But it is important that we present our concepts in a way that, to the extent possible, are meaningful and relevant to environments outside the United States and aren't arbitrarily discounted because of, inadvertent editing that's U.S.-centric. And that's a large part of the sensitivity that's important to us. And we do have two members of the council that are pretty aggressive in providing to us insights that help us remember that you know, we like to think that the guidance will be applicable globally. And certainly in my role on COSO, last year I made two presentations in Asia, and I'm going soon to make a presentation in Europe. And you know, I was surprised about the knowledge of COSO and you know, the importance in their view of COSO. So it's important to us. And just as another aside, you know, I mentioned the five organizations that sponsor COSO and the 500,000 members that we have. Well, a number of those members are from outside the United States, so we have a responsibility directly to our sponsoring organization stakeholders to really look outside the United States. So you know, to be sensitive to it not being U.S.-centric is maybe a little glib in terms of what that means exactly, but I assure you, we just don't want to unnecessarily make mistakes that result in our credibility suffering outside the United States. Let's put it that way.
Thank you, Dave. I just had one more thing I wanted to add to that, because I think that as we comment to other entities and even on the lessons learned, the European Union, I think we really pointed out that it was really important to maybe elevate the idea of COSO or other internal control frameworks. I think from an investor's perspective, that is one of our, you know, bases, our frameworks that we would rely on and ensuring that, you know, we're understanding what is happening at the companies. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have 6 tent cards up, and so we'll take those, and if you can, as we're already somewhat running over, keep your questions concise. We appreciate it. Galen Hansen.
Yeah, Professor Cox initiated the discussion about the 60% gap that then Jim alluded to, and I wanted just to ask a couple questions about that, and maybe this is more directed to you, Marty, or Keith, but even though Frank Dodd exempted these companies from 404B, could there not be some sort of link in the risk assessment standards that requires the auditors to look at and see that management actually complied with 404. I don't mean audit it, but actually did it. And it's not just simply something in the 10-K that said, yeah, we did do this, but tie it into the risk assessment to make sure that if they in fact did it, have we even read what management had to say? It seems to me like that would be a way at least of addressing whether part of this was done by someone without actually conducting an audit. Is there a way to do something like that?
Well, I think the way we've looked at that is that we looked at it through the lens of SAS 8, AU 550. So it's other information in a document containing audited financial statements. So that standard really lays out what the auditor's responsibility is. It's something we can go back and take and look at in the context of what we would do with AU 550, certainly. But that would probably be more likely to be the place rather than specifically the risk assessment.
Could we make it part of the study and evaluation of internal control to see that this was done? I guess that's where I'm getting at.
I just gave Jim Cox the note that it seems to me that we ought to be thinking about whether our risk assessment standards require or should require that the auditor audit, scope the audit, and that the scope should include whether or not management has taken into account and applied the guidelines of the modernized COSO standard. If in fact the standard is going to, if the modernized COSO standard is going to give management guidelines on the application of an effective internal control system, I would think an auditor would want to know that in the audit of a company that is not an attesting or certifying company.
And from that standpoint, there already are a number of requirements related to understanding the design of controls, and understanding controls and the design of controls, and some things, specific requirements around that probe a little bit more deeply. So to the extent that COSO, that when they update the framework, have things that we need to consider, it's certainly an opportunity to take a fresh look at that. So. Gary Cabery.
Thank you, and I'll be quick. And these are really suggestions for the team, kind of portion its time. You know, ultimately, there's probably more things you need to do than time's going to be available to it. So in terms of prioritization, I was given some thought. You know, original COSO was published in 1992, but I can remember back in the late 80s working on support for it. So this is, though the principles are timely, the world has changed a lot since then. So things where I spend my time on and where my colleagues, other companies do and boards do, that I don't think is quite in the current framework as well as it needs to be for the 21st century, what I would suggest extra time be spent in a few areas. First is, I think companies are more and more reliant on outsiders than they were in 1992. Outsourcers, if you will, but valuation firms, IT, business process outsourcing, and so on. I think time is well spent in that general area. It's one thing to outsource the process. All too often you find out you're outsourcing the responsibility. You shouldn't be. Another thing is the value, or where the value are in companies, I think continues to change. And more of companies' value today in risk today is in the intellectual property, whether it's intangibles, whether it's software, whether it's IP, and on and on. And again, I think the current framework, you know, worked a little bit better in, for lack of a better term, an industrial age society as opposed to intellectual age society. So again, just in terms of allocating time, I would suggest you look into there. I think today, a couple people here talked about enterprise risk management at the board levels and stuff. That's where a lot of action is. And the more you can tie the updated framework to the most modern theories or practices for ERM would be well served for everybody. And then lastly, I think, again, it's in there today, but I think it needs a refresh. The true internal independence and effectiveness of the governance organizations. So the internal audit, the accounting, your ethics office, compliance office, legal, and so on. Perhaps more so dealing with, I'll call it, the tone at the top and related entity-wide controls. But again, I think they were all have to get by doing more with less people and so on. The world of, you know, budgetary control exists on all of us. So again, these groups need to be independent. They need to be effective. Thanks.
Gary, they're terrific points, some of which we've touched upon, but to have your added, to us be sensitive to your added comments are very helpful. The risk assessment component is one where, at the end of the day, may be most affected, or we may have, let's say this, the opportunity to enhance its robustness, and that, you know, directly relates to your ERM comment. We've made those comments in the advisory council meetings. But interestingly, it really touches upon your intellectual property and your outsourcing in today's environment comment too. They're just very good comments, and I appreciate them.
Arnie Hanisch.
Just a couple of other comments in the same spirit as Gary's. I don't know if this is I don't know really if it's within the authority of the COSO or within the framework of what you're doing, but it seems like it can fit into the governance and tone at the top issue that I still believe that there's some need to beef up and deal with the issue of financial experts on the boards. You mentioned that, well, we have financial experts on boards as a result of SOX, but there's no real definition of what a financial expert is, in my view. And having been involved with audit committees, as I have for the last 24 years, you see a wide variety of individuals that would hold themselves out to be financial experts. And I think that Congress failed to adequately address it when they passed SOX and fell short of really putting some meat around it. And I don't know if there's any opportunity to build into your framework, into a revised framework, some guidance, thoughts as to how you compose a board and audit committee and have individuals who, at least in my mind, truly do have an expertise well enough to be able to recognize issues, ask the right questions of both the company executives as well as the auditors. We talk about communications with auditors, but, you know, it goes the other way. And people need to know what the right questions are to ask. And I just don't believe that many members of audit committees really understand well enough in the complex areas that we're dealing with today and the complexity of FASB rules that do they really do understand the right questions to ask of us as accountants and company management. So if there's some way to build that into a framework, enhance, put some more meat around the governance tone at the top, I think that would be helpful from a control perspective.
Thank you. Again, very helpful. I chair two audit committees. I know there's a wide difference between people who are designated as audit committee financial experts as to their true expertise, and it's an interesting observation that I hadn't really thought about before today. It was alluded to in an earlier comment as well about if we can put guidance that really helps with an understanding of what good governance is in terms of having financial experts. I think it's an outstanding comment.
Steve Holmes.
My question actually turned into a comment after the last 10 or 15 minutes, but I'll throw my two cents in anyway. And as an external auditor and an internal auditor for a large part of my career, I do believe that one of the areas of greatest opportunity is where we could find that linkage between enterprise risk management and both internal and external auditors, and to strengthen that and leverage the enterprise risk management process, because I believe that generally out there in the business community, if you will, that is I won't say a weakness, but a potential soft spot. And also, once we engage in that process, or once ERM engages in the process of identification of business risks, operational risks, so on and so forth, a definition of what may be auditable versus what could potentially be unauditable would be helpful.
Okay, thank you. Again, on my audit committee experience, it's interesting because more than once I've commented that the ERM group and the external auditors need to make sure they're in sync in terms of focus when, for example, in the fraud area, the external auditors are required to do brainstorming. You know, it's nice that there's an interchange of that information with the ERM group and vice versa. You know, so that linkage is an interesting point.
Brian Croteau, do you want to weigh in on something?
Yeah, thanks, Keith. And as always, these remarks are my own. But just wanted to comments on a couple things here. First, I appreciate those who have reminded everyone about the requirements still for non-accelerated filers and management's report on ICFR, and Keith, for your remarks with respect to AU 550 and the auditor's responsibility to consider management's report, read management's report, and consider whether there's anything inconsistent in management's report on ICFR with what they've learned in conducting the audit. Surely the comments around considering whether in light of the exemption from 404B for non-accelerated filers, whether there should be any other considerations with respect to AU 550 or other auditing standards in you know, those types of audits seems like a reasonable thing to give thought to, but not forget that we've got requirements today. Another thought is some of what I'm hearing, it seems like one of the things that we should keep in mind and seems to be important here is in the ICFR context, companies will need to continue to make statements about effectiveness of controls in the context of ICFR and surely understand the operational controls observations as well as compliance controls observations to the extent that the framework begins to combine some of those in ways that is not the case today. I think it's just important that it's going to be sufficiently clear when someone's making an assertion that they are effective in compliance with the COSO framework or any other framework, what that means in the context of ICFR. And I think, Dave, you've teed that up in terms of creating a separate document. However that's done, I think that type of a document or just making sure that's going to be clear is important. And then the last observation I just wanted to make was it seems like some of the comments that I've heard, there's some guidance in COSO's guidance for smaller public companies that might be important and should continue to be relevant in the context certainly of smaller public companies that are still complying with 404A, and so not sure how you plan to, Dave, consider that, but I think that guidance is still very important and useful.
Thank you. On the latter comment, it's an issue that we have to deal with because we do plan to supersede, and it wasn't clear in my slide deck, the 2006 small business guidance and integrate that in some way to this guidance. And that's a tentative conclusion, but one of the reasons that drives us to that is that we want to be explicit in developing and articulating the principles, and that was such a major important part of the 2006 small business guidance that it will make it awkward, I think, if the two documents are both out there. So we therefore need to get documents that are, or I mean, guidance that's relevant to truly relevant to small businesses as opposed to relevant to everybody, make sure that we're sensitive to getting that someplace. So that's you hit on a point that's important to us. And another point that you touched upon, we've touched upon, I think it's relevant really to the PCAOB, and that is the issue of what constitutes effectiveness. And so, for example, when we have, let's say, 20 principles, and we presume that, you know, though each of those principles should be supported in a determination of the effectiveness of the controls, then if one of those principles isn't supported adequately, does that mean the controls are ineffective? And if the answer is yes, then is it a material weakness? And so there's that kind of effectiveness question that we're just beginning to touch on that we'd welcome. We can do it offline because I know time's limited, but any comments that you have in effect on how you look at what constitutes a material weakness and what constitutes effectiveness, particularly in the light of recognizing that we'd have these 20 principles or so articulated explicitly in the document rather than implicit, as the case with the 92 framework.
Lynn Turner.
Thank you. David, back when the original COSO report and framework was being developed in the late 80s and early 90s, I remember that the commission staff at the time said there was one major missing principle in the COSO framework, and that was there was nothing that talked about the need for companies to be identifying changes that were going on in business, industry, trend, or the company, and that that needed to be a very fundamental part of the framework and a very fundamental part of the pillar. And, of course, COSO decided to leave it out. I think one of the lessons that we've learned in this financial crisis was, indeed, that pillar should have been in and at the forefront as businesses changed and became more active in securitization, changed their business to where they no longer had skin in the game. And yet it's very clear from what we're seeing that companies didn't react to that from the internal control perspective, and we've all paid a serious price now. So I would, one, urge you to go back and reconsider that and put in as one of the pillars the fact that unless you've got something inside the business, a control inside the business that is looking for those type of changes and reacting to them to make sure that you're just not always behind the eight ball, that you're going to have this type of problem. I would also turn around and say that Chairman Doty's comment about the need for auditors to properly plan and scope these audits along the lines he discussed, I think were right on point and very good. I'd reiterate the same thing with respect to the comments you've heard about directors from Arnie and Joe Carcello and others around the table. I think we've probably given way too much credit to directors. I was recently had a conversation with the people over at the NACD, and it's very clear that many of the people on the audit committees just don't know the right questions to ask. So I would encourage you to put in a whole chapter just for the audit committees, not only what you expect, but what auditors should be looking for as far as what the audit committee should be asking, and if those type of things aren't being asked, then you got a problem, quite frankly. And it seems like, especially as we've seen from recent revelations from the FCIC and the documents that they've made public, that a number of these audit committees in these large banks were literally clueless, and that's perhaps the best you can say about it, but clueless when it came to risk management and some of the internal controls. And if you had a bank audit committee that was that clueless, it raised the question, how could you have ever had effective internal controls, let alone the right tone at the top? On the fraud side of things, I'd suggest you go back and build something into it along the lines of what the American Association of Certified Fraud Examiners have talked about with respect to whistleblowers. That's clearly been documented for several years running now, that that is the one thing that seems to detect fraud. And yet today, we still see auditors that don't have an understanding of whether that system works or not, don't know how it works, don't know if it's independent or not. And I don't understand how that occurs. So I think as you build the whistleblower thing, something about the whistleblower thing I think is very important, because while there's a lot of discussion today about the SEC proposed rules, I don't think that's where a lot of the whistleblower complaints are going to go in the future. I think they're going to go to WikiLeaks, because by going to WikiLeaks, you can guarantee your confidentiality. And as we move to a Facebook world, the social internet, you don't want to go through the company because you could lose your job, you get identified, but WikiLeaks guarantees you confidentiality. And I think as that becomes more prominent, that whistleblower thing is going to be a fascinating thing to watch. And last, I just reiterate what Gary said about outsourcing. It seems like with all the outsourcing going on that you could almost make a chapter just on outsourcing itself. And I think Gary's point about you can outsource the work, but not the responsibility, is so vitally important here.
Thank you. Very, very helpful reinforcement of points, Lynn. Whistleblowing is interesting to me, particularly interesting because I do have a firsthand experience, again, chairing an audit committee where we've looked pretty hard at the whistleblowing and it's just not as easy as you might think to really assess whether it's effective or not. You know, I mean, you can have things in the program that on paper look great, and you really.
I've chaired three audit committees, and I guess, David, I'd have a different view than you on that. I think you can get the whistleblower program up and running, and I think you can.
Oh, we have it up and running. That's not the problem.
I think you can make it somewhat effective in today's environment with all the tools you have. But I think people have got to dedicate some time and resources to actually making it work. And from what I've seen, not all of them are that effective yet to this day.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Running short of time, last but not least, Damon Silvers.
I wanted to add to some things Lynn said. It seems to me that sort of behind some of this conversation is that we have a framework here that is to some degree built and has in mind a world of discrete organizations, and we live increasingly in a world of networks, or people who think they have networks, and that you can see this at play in this phenomenon as diverse as the mortgage irregularities that are currently being negotiated by the state attorneys general and the economic impact of the earthquake in Japan on firms who had no idea that they had Japanese operations. In fact, don't have Japanese operations, but yet are significantly affected by a set of networks that go beyond their line of sight. The implications of that for internal controls go right to this issue of that I think was raised several comments back, and that I think Lynn was reflecting on somewhat, which is the question of what's the relationship between financial reporting and systems of internal controls around supposedly non-financial activity. And there really is no better example of how these things are completely intertwined than the mortgage irregularity situation, where you now have, I believe, all four of the company's major banks having filed with the SEC statements to the effect of that they're expecting material regulatory costs associated with that problem. I think they would have denied that six months ago, and I assume they might have even denied that honestly 6 months ago. It doesn't appear as though these very large organizations had any idea what the nature of the true nature of a variety of absolutely critical contractual arrangements were inside their organizations or inside their networks. So again, this is a network problem. It ties in again also to Jim Cox's point about what are the implications of exempting folks, because part of what went on here in the mortgage irregularities matter was that there were no full-fledged audits of the securitization vehicles. Now, it turned out, but there were audits of servicers. You could sort of say, well, this is an issue of people being exempted from the audit process, but they actually weren't. And that would seem to raise some pretty significant questions. Finally, all of these issues require boards, governance systems, and boards that are substantively able to understand the organizations and the networks they are operating in. And I can tell you that from the interactions that union pension funds had with some of the boards of the major banks long before the irregularities issue arose, I can tell you from firsthand experience talking to those board members that one of two things is true. Either key decision makers in those firms had no idea the nature of the firms and networks that they were overseeing, or else they thought they could fool us into believing that they didn't. I'm not sure which one it was. I don't think it really matters. I suspect it was the former, sadly enough. I suspect that actually it was true that the leaders of audit committees at major financial institutions simply didn't understand the nature of the businesses they were overseeing. And I think all of this goes, I think, to the wisdom of many of the questions that were discussed here earlier and the kind of general path that you're on, But I want to enforce these points so that anyone who suggests that perhaps these are minor matters or debatable ones or insignificant in terms of financial reporting, these are the biggest matters facing our country's economy and our system of financial regulation today.
Damon and others, thank you for your points. And I think Dave and Miles, hopefully you've got plenty of input from our SAG, which is typical of any topic we have here. We get that kind of input. So we appreciate you coming here and telling us about this important project and your plans. And we look forward to working with you. As I'm not sure you mentioned it, but the PCAOB and the SEC are both observers to this project, and so we're staying very closely attuned to it.
You're very supportive in your observer role. I should have mentioned that earlier, and today, I mean, some wonderfully thoughtful comments. They're very helpful to us, and Miles and I are very appreciative. And if and when you have further comments, we would welcome them. You can provide them through our COSO website, or maybe easier, I could just, my email is dlland@aol.com, and I welcome any elaboration of the comments you made today or any additional comments, because they are very, very helpful to us, and Miles and I are very appreciative, and it's been very worthwhile from our standpoint, as I knew it would be.
Again, thank you very much. All right. A very important topic and a very thorough conversation about that. Another important topic is financial statement disclosures. And to introduce this subject, Board Member Dan Gelzer, I believe, has a couple of comments to make. Dan?
Thanks very much, Marty. We don't have a separate presentation on auditing financial statement disclosures the way we've heard on the FASB's standard-setting agenda or on the COSO refresh project. So I thought I'd take just a minute to hit some of the high points that are in the briefing paper that was distributed to you. If nothing else, that'll give you a minute or two to switch topics mentally and think about what comments and recommendations you might have with respect to the challenges of auditing disclosures. Of course, financial statement disclosures have become a key component of public company financial reporting. Over a period of years, the FASB has expanded the nature and scope of the disclosures that are required in financial statements. Today, the notes to a public company's financial statements frequently run many pages in length and cover topics ranging from the selection of accounting principles to the assumptions underlying fair value assumptions. I think Larry Smith suggested earlier that they could be measured better with a scale than with a page count in some cases. In any event, the transformation of financial statements from a series of line items into a more comprehensive textual disclosure presentation is the result of the increasing complexity of business transactions, the increased use of fair value and other estimates, and of the demands of financial statement users for more relevant information. Again, as we've heard already today, financial statement disclosures are still evolving. In particular, some recent and proposed accounting standards contain disclosure requirements that are objectives-based and explicitly depend on the exercise of judgment. I'll refer to something that Denny Beresford referred to before lunch this morning. The proposed financial instruments ASU requires the reporting entity to determine, in light of facts and circumstances, how much detail it is required to provide and how it disaggregates information into classes for assets with different risk characteristics. It goes on to say that the entity should strike a balance between obscuring important information as a result of too much aggregation and overburdening financial statements with excessive detail that may not assist financial statement users in understanding the entity's financial instruments and allowance for credit losses. Exactly how that balance is supposed to be struck, however, is left to the reporting entity. Obviously, complying with this sort of requirement will require the exercise of considerable judgment. A financial statement audit encompasses the disclosures, and therefore, as the scope and complexity of disclosures increase, the scope and sophistication of the auditor's work also needs to increase. Under existing PCAOB standards, auditors are required to plan and perform the audit to obtain reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements are presented fairly in all material respects in accordance with the applicable financial reporting framework. That includes performing procedures to test the disclosures and to evaluate whether the financial statements contain all of the required disclosures and all of the information essential for a fair presentation. The board's original interim standards, which we adopted back in April of 2003, certainly took financial statement disclosures into account, and the recently adopted risk assessment standards call for auditors to devote still more attention to disclosures. For example, AS number 12 requires the auditor to develop expectations about the disclosures that are necessary for the company's financial statements to be presented fairly in conformity with the reporting framework. PCAOB standards also require auditors to perform procedures to assess the risk of omitted, incomplete, or inaccurate disclosures and to identify and test significant disclosures. And in an integrated audit, AS5 requires the auditor to test controls over significant disclosures. So, during the discussion this afternoon, we're interested in learning about the challenges that the financial statement disclosure requirements pose for auditors. We'd also like to understand how auditors are addressing those challenges and how preparers and investors see the auditor's role in this area. The board's particularly interested in SAG views about whether there are further changes that we should be considering to the auditing standards or whether there are other kinds of guidance that we should be issuing with respect to the auditor's work in reviewing financial statement disclosures. So I hope that sets the stage for the discussion. With that, I'll turn the floor over to Keith Wilson to lead the discussion.
Thanks, Dan. Building on Dan's remarks, I just want to point out that the PCAOB standards, especially the new risk assessment standards, provide that foundational set of requirements for evaluating disclosures, and particularly they require the auditor to go beyond just the looking at the old historical disclosure checklist, but it's do the stand back and evaluate whether those disclosures provide the information essential for fair presentation so that investors and other users of the financial statements can fully understand the company's financial condition and results of operations. This afternoon, we want to try and focus on specific issues and challenges related to evaluating disclosures and interested in hearing your views on issues such as those that Dan raised. So I guess we'll begin with Denny Beresford.
I'm in favor of disclosure. Having overseen as the chairman of the audit committee the 10-K for Fannie Mae that runs approximately 500 pages, how can I not be? Going back to my former life at the FASB, one of the last projects that was undertaken before I left was one that was called disclosure effectiveness. It was actually brought up as disclosure overload, especially by smaller companies, smaller CPA firms, and smaller corporations, much the same as the more recent small gap project. And the board took it up. I frankly was in favor. A lot of the other board members were not, but we did take it up and felt that it wasn't just a question of too much, but whether the disclosures were as effective as they should be. And that led, after I left, to I think it was statement 138 that dealt with disclosures. It was kind of an experiment, disclosures on OPEB and pensions, where we actually expanded the disclosures in those particular areas. And as soon as I got out the door, the FASB abandoned that project on disclosures and went back to their normal way of dealing with things. In looking, I think it's in the paper, but it perhaps isn't organized as it could be, but I see the approach that the board, the FASB, has kind of taken to this, and frankly the approach that the PCAOB could take is sort of in three categories. One is sort of an overall approach, kind of a conceptual approach. You might say it's kind of the apple pie and motherhood approach of looking at it conceptually overall, like the SEC has taken to provide all the necessary information so that the users will have the necessary information understanding the financial statements, whatever additional information, the footnotes and so forth, to understand what's in the financial statements and what other information you have to provide to supplement those financial information, that information. The board has never, as Larry said before, really described the framework for the disclosures. It's been more in the area of the individual assets and liabilities and things of that nature. So there hasn't been this overall, what I would call kind of the forest versus the trees approach that's been taken. But everybody kind of agrees on that as an overriding objective. The second area, which is really the way that the board, I think, has approached things over the years, is what I would call kind of the specific topic approach. Every project that the FASB takes on, I think it pretty much continues to this day, the board goes through a number of recognition and measurement issues, whether it's pensions or leases or whatever, and debates for effectively 23 and a half hours on recognition and measurement issues. And the last half hour, 15 minutes says, okay, we've decided all these things. Now what disclosure should we add to the project? I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they tend to not to be the kind of the high point of the discussion. It's more just after we've done these things, what additional things should we add to disclosure, and never usually in the context of what is the total package that we have here now, what things should we have for this particular topic that we have in mind, and never in the context of maybe we should take a little bit away from some other areas that have become less important over time. Then the third approach, and this is kind of a subset, I guess you might say, of the other ones, is what I would call the trees approach, and that is just where over time, because of these other approaches, the in particular the second one, we just have a whole long list, the so-called gap checklist that the accounting firms have put together, where we have, I don't even know how many items now, Mike, we would have if you had to print out the whole list, but 150 pages?
No, more than 50.
More than 50 pages, and so probably several hundred, if not into the thousands of items of individual disclosure requirements, most of which tie into some of these specific subject matter areas, but some of which are kind of freestanding at this point. And so the accounting firms and the corporate staffs go through and look at each of these things and make a decision. Either they do apply to a particular company, sometimes they apply but they're judged qualitatively that they're not material, or if they don't apply, obviously you don't disclose them. The problem that I think we have here, and it's again alluded to in the paper, is that in many of these cases, particularly for a very large corporation, they're present, but they're really not very important to the company. But there's really no basis for deciding. There's no guideline we have. We obviously all look for guidelines these days on how do we make the decision not to put something in when it literally is present. And the SEC staff has, in many cases, then sent us letters on occasions where there have been some of these situations where they've said, how come you didn't comply with AU, whatever it is now, the particular codification standard that says this particular thing is necessary, and the company says, well, we don't think it's very important, but it actually is present. These days, the easier role is to just go ahead and comply and add one more thing to the standard so that Fannie Mae's financial statement footnotes are now something like 135 pages long. And it's nice to have guidance like the FASB has put in these last two proposals right now to say, make a judgment as to whether you are now overloading the users of the financial statements to the point where they can't really understand what's there. But it's it just becomes unrealistic. My in addition to giving kind of a semi-speech here, Marty, which I didn't really intend, my real point here, I think, is simply I'm concerned about having a project at the PCAOB that would lead to standard setting that would start introducing the notion of looking for specific auditing requirements to start ferreting out what I would call kind of a trees approach on disclosures for all of these individual things, because you will find them. And you will find that there are 100 or 50 pages times 15 items per page, and then you will have to make all these individual judgments. I think I would rather have some sort of an overall framework, if that's possible, that would approach this more conceptual type of a judgment to help, whether it's the FASB or to help the financial preparers deal with this issue of how to start getting us back into balance and having an overall package of information, whether it's in the footnotes and or the management discussion analysis, that the users of financial statements can actually make some better use of. One last point. I don't know if this is an auditing requirement or exactly what the context is now, but I've observed on being on, as I said, four boards, that it's not consistent from auditing firm to auditing firm or even within the firms. The firms are consistent in terms of giving me a summary of auditing different auditing adjustments passed, but only one case do they give me a summary of disclosures passed. I don't know how widespread that is in practice. As I said, in one case, I get a list of disclosures that they thought were present, but they decided were immaterial and therefore were not made. They want to bring that to the attention of the audit committee so that we have that information. In the other three cases, I'm convinced that there would be those kinds of things that would be present as well. And I'm not asking for that information, frankly, because I don't think it would provide me anything more useful. But I think it's something that at least in practice, there ought to be some consistency about. So I just make that as an additional observation. Thank you.
Well, thanks for those comments and your views that to the extent we look at further project, we think of a disclosure framework ourselves for auditing disclosures as opposed to further checklists about has every disclosure been made. I do think, to the extent one had a chance to look at the appendix and the document and the additional information that was put into the standards that were issued in the past year, I think many of those go to more principles-based of an auditor making a judgment about expectations, as Dan mentioned in the beginning, and setting your scope of what disclosures are going to be appropriate here, and also sitting back and looking at the financial statements and making a judgment that the disclosures tell the appropriate story with respect to the risks of material misstatement and the information that the readers need to know about the important elements in the financial statements. But I think your points are very well made and well taken, and we'll consider that as we can think about further standard setting. I don't know, Keith, if you wanted to expand on what I just said.
The only other thing I would add to that is we, in teeing up this discussion, we didn't really intend that we were going to go out and have a bunch of additional specific requirements to say auditors make sure the company discloses this information in this particular account. Nothing that specific. We're really, in fact, we're trying to move to be completely accounting financial reporting framework neutral. So it wouldn't be consistent with that view to be trying to put in a bunch of specific additional backdoor disclosure requirements. Rather, we would look to the individual accounting standard setters for the lion's share of that, and as Marty said, to have more of a principles kind of approach. We're just trying to tee up, for purposes of this discussion, are there particular issues that are challenges associated with this that, that we should be thinking about? Jay Hansen, did you want to weigh in on that? I know we're out of turn, but...
I actually wanted to weigh in and respond to something that, that Denny said, because I absolutely agree with you that, that we have a lot of trees, and the I'm surprised if you say the checklist is only 50 pages. I thought it was more like 150 pages.
More than
a lot more than 50 pages. And the challenge of when you get done with it, and it's usually as the in the auditor's shop assigned to about a 3-year staff person to go through it. That when you get done, you feel sort of okay that you might have complied. But that act of stepping back and saying, do these financial statements tell the story, that's a big missing step in it. And I full well appreciate the incremental nature of every new disclosure, having been an EITF member and argued about some of the things that I ultimately agreed to put in that are more tending towards MD&A-like disclosures and the additional challenge that that creates. Auditors have a hard enough time auditing the past, much less the future-oriented statements that some of the disclosures have. And one thing I think the PCOB as a board needs to be mindful of in our organization that we are trying to ensure that the auditors are doing their jobs, which is ensuring that the preparers are doing their jobs, and even though there might be things that we look at and step back holistically, say, gee, it sure would have been nice if this would have been disclosed, even though there's nothing there to point to, we need to wrestle with what are we going to do about those situations, because oftentimes we are in that unique position of looking in after the fact, knowing some hindsight, and a little more time than the audit team typically has when they're on the ground trying to get things done by February 28th. That's just a vexing problem we have. Is our hindsight is awfully good, but we weren't on the ground at the time to make to be involved when the decisions were made, and we didn't make the rules on what needs to be disclosed. And so it's a real challenge we have. So any advice that any of you have for us and that balance, we're all ears. We don't have the answer to that quite as clearly. We know things need to be done, but we're struggling, and we don't want to be in a he said, she said. It's not my job, it's Larry's job or Brian's job, but we need to work on this together. And that's, as Jim mentioned earlier, this financial reporting series that the SEC is taking the lead on is going to be really important to explore some of these issues. And an even more important one, Denny, to your point about the list of waived disclosures, is how does management evaluate, well, when is it appropriate to say, you know, even though this does apply, it really isn't very relevant, and these financial statements would be better suited to not obscure the important with 10 pages of it is applies, but it's really not very important. So, real challenge.
Thank you. We are going to try to start going through this in order, but I just have a feeling Larry Smith wants to chime. No, okay, all right. Then Scott Showalter.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually. It's not about the volume, it's about how to audit. And over 30-some years ago when I started auditing, footnotes were pretty straightforward, and most of the time they were summaries or what was line items on the balance sheet income statement. And what brought my attention to this was whether auditors are properly prepared to be able to audit this information. And the IAASB issued a discussion paper on disclosure and implications, and they have a pretty good sentence in here that talks about the fact that it's clear that the financial statements are now more likely to include a broad variety of disclosures, some of which are not even derived from accounting systems, and may include forward-looking information, disclosures of uncertainty, and models. And so if I go over and look at AS-15 on audit evidence, what I'm seeing is, which is not inconsistent with AICPA, is what I'd say audit evidence has been around for 20 or 30 years. And so my question is whether we need to provide guidance to auditors on what type of evidence qualifies as evidence in a lot of these areas that you're looking at. And we're involving more and more specialists, engineering, valuations, people, and all types of things that may think about evidence different than we do. And so my question is, can we learn from other people that we're relying on in auditing financial statements is, are there different types of evidence? I would challenge that our current standards focus more on 20th century evidence as opposed to 21st century evidence, and if there's any way to help our auditors with different ways to audit these disclosures, I think could be very helpful.
Joe Corsello.
A couple of comments. First of all, let me second what Jay said. I think it's an excellent point. My sense from both when I was in practice many years ago but in talking to practitioners now, the firms develop these checklists. They have third or fourth year people go through them. They look to make sure the disclosures are there. They look to maybe get comfortable with the numbers. But I don't think that a lot's done around the words. And the words are what really tell the story. And so I think that's something for the board to think about. The second comment is, when I saw that this topic was on the agenda, I thought it might be useful to offer some unique data. Academics like unique data. And so what I did is I took all of your inspection reports that had been issued from day one through February of 2011, 10,511 pages, and I looked to see how often disclosure deficiencies were found by you. And so let me give you the number, and then I'll give two hypotheses around the number, okay? 16, this is the big four. 16 across the big four. Now, there's four firms, 7 years. This is 2003 to 2009 inspections. I say, let's assume that at each big four inspection, you take 50 clients. That's just the number I used. So if you multiply all that out, that's 1,400. 16 across a base of 1,400, that's around 1%. So here's the two hypotheses, right? One hypothesis is that the issuers and the auditors are doing a spectacular job, and that's why there's only a 1% hit rate. The other hypothesis is you're not doing as good a job as in this area as maybe you can be doing. Not you, Marty, not your group, but this is more broadly for the board.
Yeah, some other group, not us.
Some other group. But the five board members oversee everybody. This is something I think to think about. And one of the things I found telling, and this ties into Denny's comment, that on an audit committee, he doesn't get, I think one firm gives him a schedule of past disclosures, the others don't. I won't embarrass the firm, but one of the big four firms, in their response, and this is now a quote, more than half of the exceptions noted related to presentation and disclosure matters. Like, oh, that's a sin, but it's a minor sin. And I think that's how we've often viewed this, is disclosure as a second-class citizen. And I think given the trend in FASB standards over the last 10, 15 years, if not longer, where disclosure is now more integral to the standard than in the past, where it might have been 2 to 3 paragraphs at the very end, I think we need to give equal attention to disclosure issues as we give recognition and measurement issues.
Good point. Wayne Collins?
Thank you. It seems to me that developing standards for assessing the adequacy of disclosure is quite like developing standards for how to evaluate an impressionist painting. There's so many nuances. And if you look at the 50-plus pages or the 150 pages, whatever it is, of disclosures, these are individual disclosures, granular disclosures. This doesn't really get back to say, well, does the whole picture really portray what reality is? And you've got now the new objective-based requirements, which pretty much mirror, I guess, the concept statement about what is deemed to be material for a reasonable user of the financial statements. It's a very, very broad requirement and difficult to implement. And from an audit standpoint, it's even more difficult without the framework in place from the preparer standpoint. So hearing that the FASB does have a project underway for disclosure framework, I think it would be well to have that project get underway and have the PCAB work with the FASB in terms of the auditing concepts that would go into it, rather than having a parallel project initiated from the auditing standpoint. I mean, this is initially a preparer issue that then needs to be audited.
I think that's a good point, and we are certainly very interested in the FASB disclosure framework project. So point well taken, Wayne. Thanks.
Arch Amo.
some others have teed up a little bit of what I was going to talk about as well. I mean, certainly disclosures over the years have become increasingly complex, and the extent of the judgment required in terms of what goes into those disclosures has become more complex. Wayne just mentioned this aspect of the new standards, and there's a quote here in your document referring to the revenue proposed standard that says, in connection with disclosures, if the entity has not met the disclosure objective of the particular standard, then the entity shall disclose whatever additional information is necessary to meet that objective. Well, that's certainly going to, you talk about challenges, that's certainly going to increase the challenge on the preparers and the auditors to be, when they're looking at that aspect of disclosures. The other thing I wanted to mention was this paper that Scott brought up from the IAASB. It lays out a lot of the issues, I think, in a very orderly and nice way, in a complete way, about the evolving nature of financial reporting and the disclosure and the audit implications. There's a series of consultation questions that are specifically addressed to preparers, investors, regulators, and auditors. And I didn't mention this before, but I serve on the IAASB, and we are certainly hoping for some robust responses from all of those groups to help us in this. And I know that, Marty, that with the relationship and that that you all have and you follow the IAASB activities, you'll keep on top of this. We'll certainly be providing input to you as we get responses there. But it does cover a lot of things with the complexity of this. From a standpoint of the standards themselves, they're always something that have to be considered. But when I look at the risk-based standards and the way that you've laid out in your standards the disclosure aspect of a risk assessment, my initial reaction is that those risk standards currently are pointing the auditors to where they need to what they need to be considering with respect to disclosures. Now, maybe there's some implementation guidance that you might offer up in the future, depending upon what types of things you're seeing in that your inspections group are running across. But conceptually, I think the risk-based standards are pointing us in the right direction.
That's good to hear. And yes, we are well aware of, as you indicated, the IAASB project as well, and I've read that paper, and we'll be staying close to responses you get to the consultation paper, et cetera, and take that into account. Thanks for that.
Barbara Roper.
As I've been listening to this discussion, it occurs to me that the comment that I had in mind when I started may be slightly off point, because I was thinking about this in terms of auditing the financial statements as opposed to auditing the financial statement disclosures, and it's not always clear to us outsiders exactly what you all mean by your specific terms. But the requirement that the financial statements include whatever information necessary makes them not, to make them not misleading, I think provides enough of a hook for my comments that I'm going to go ahead and make them anyway, which is that as we increasingly move toward more subjective and more standards and more use of judgment, it places a premium on auditors' willingness and ability to exercise independent judgment and to show professional skepticism in how they assess the adequacy of these financial statement disclosures. And as you know, I think the FSA in the recent crisis commented on the worrying lack of professional skepticism that they had found in the audits of a number of large financial institutions. And so I think that in turn raises the issue. It puts a premium on auditor independence, and that you can't sort of separate, if you want to get toward effective disclosure, if you want to get toward good financial reporting and good sound audits, it's not just about auditing standards, it is about independence and what we're going to do finally at some point to make the auditors truly independent in this process.
Doug Carmichael.
Words are very important,
And I was poring over the words and some of the standards you give as examples. And one of them says, if financial statements, including accompany notes, fail to disclose information that is required by generally accepted accounting principles, then you do something. And the modern version of that is, for a fair presentation of the financial statements in conformity with the applicable financial reporting framework. Now, either of those phrases lead to looking at it in terms of, are all the disclosures there that are required by the accounting pronouncements? And it's really necessary to counteract that very directly by the words that are used. The notion that is in the auditing standard on what fair presentation and conformity with GAAP means, saying that it means that you include all the information necessary for a user to really understand what's going on, that's a paraphrase, of course, is the right notion, but you don't find that concept in the accounting standards. And I think it's nice that the FASB is working on a disclosure framework, but I think we need, as soon as possible, a very simple accounting standard that states the basic bottom line on the need for the step-back evaluation to tell the story. That needs to be part of the accounting standards, and it shouldn't take a really long time to do. You don't need an elaborate disclosure framework to put that into the accounting standards and make it an operational requirement for auditors instead of the way it's interpreted usually now as a long checklist to see whether all the points in the accounting pronouncements have been covered.
I think that's a very good point, and that I think that's the essence of the discussion we're trying to get into here, is that auditing financial statements and then related disclosures, is it a compliance exercise of because of the way the standards, accounting standards, are set up, or are auditing standards appropriate such that the auditor does step back to determine that the financial statements and all the disclosures tell the entire story? But I think it gets to the point of sort of Denny's comment to begin this all off with, and that is sometimes it seems like the disclosures are sort of a checklist afterthought as opposed to a comprehensive framework in terms of here's what disclosures should do as part of the financial statements. And I wonder, Larry, if it's a good time to turn to you. There have been a number of comments about that, and I don't know if your point's on that or not.
My points weren't directly on that, but first of all, our consideration of disclosures doesn't occur at 23 and a half hours. It's 21 and a half, but I guess what I'm reading into the suggestion by Doug is that you would like some type of a materiality framework to evaluate whether the disclosures that are required but might be missing effectively, so that people can evaluate whether the lack of that disclosure is really material to the users of financial statements. At least that's what I hear you, something like that. Is that what you're after?
Yes, something like that. It would evaluate whether the information is important. Let me just tell the short story that a lot of people are familiar with. We have, as the law of the land in the United States today, a case called U.S. versus Simon. And we have the U.S. versus Simon decision that says effectively professional standards aren't a complete defense because in that case, a company called Continental Vending loaned money to an affiliate, Valley Stream, and Valley Stream in turn loaned money, that same money, to the president of Continental Vending, and that wasn't disclosed in the financial statements. A very young U.S. attorney, Peter Fleming Jr., brought a case against the auditors in that circumstance. The lead partner on the engagement, Carl Simon, is the Simon in U.S. versus Simon. And at that time, there were eight large firms, and the managing partners of seven of the eight firms, the seven not being the one involved, all came into court and testified that disclosure of those related party transactions was not required by generally accepted accounting principles. As a result, Judge Friendly, in making the appellate decision, had to come forward and say, well, it's not important what GAAP requires. It's important that there be fair disclosure. And adherence to the accounting standards, the fact that GAAP didn't require that disclosure, is really not a defense. And we've got that now as the law of the land because of that very narrow view of what adequate disclosure is, that adequate disclosure merely means have you ticked off that it's required by an accounting pronouncement. And I think it would be important to have an accounting pronouncement that stated that as part of GAAP, you have this very basic disclosure responsibility to evaluate whether the information is there that a reasonable investor would be interested in.
Okay, can I follow up on that then? Because that leads me to a couple of the other points that I had. And we've had people suggest to us that we should write a standard on materiality, which might go beyond what you're just suggesting. So let me take that back and we'll mull over it. But it's interesting that what you're suggesting we do is the absolute opposite of what Arch just said was a problem with the little synopsis of the revenue recognition standard. So I find it interesting that the two of you are totally, citing things that we should consider, and they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. Because, and part of the problem is that a lot of the summaries or the quotes that have been taken relative to our recent disclosure requirements have been taken out of context. Okay, the implication is that that's all we required, and that's not the case. In revenue recognition, yes, we did add that little provision in there, in addition to a number of required disclosures, and we added it because revenue recognition methodologies, et cetera, are so diverse and transactions are so diverse, we didn't know if we would adequately cover what would be useful information to users. So we added that general provision in terms of look at the disclosures, look at the objectives, and see if the disclosures you've made accomplish those objectives. And if not, you might want to consider disclosing something else. I mean, it's a fairly simple concept. Likewise, in terms of the disclosures about not putting too much in but not putting too little in that Denny and both Dan cited earlier, you should realize that that provision is in documents that include a number of specific disclosure requirements. So, in other words, we gave you what we thought should be disclosed, but we can't tell you, how to aggregate or disaggregate things in terms of, whether you're communicating useful information to users of financial statements. So those are the two comments I have to make. And then I just want to give you an observation, and whether you consider this if you move forward with any kind of a disclosure standard or not, since there are a number of auditors here, you might want to hear what we've heard at a couple of our observer or roundtable type meetings that we have with constituent groups. And I'll at least summarize the group so you can understand the context in which the statements were made. But both when we met with representatives of NACUBO, which is an organization of business officers of universities and colleges, and when we met with our own not-for-profit advisory committee, which is a newly formed committee consisting of a bunch of not-for-profit people, they have told us in our discussions about disclosures that their auditors are preventing them from making disclosures in their financial statements if the disclosures are not required by GAAP. And I've sat in those meetings and heard that with dismay because I can't understand how an auditor can prevent somebody from disclosing something as long as it's not material inconsistent with the financial statements. But I just throw that out for you to consider, you know, in your own respective shops. I did not.
Okay, Nary Bucks fan.
Thank you. A few observations. First, I concur.
Can you first refute on my behalf, Larry's?
Oh, your behalf? without getting into that, what I would like to do is just speak to couple topics. First, I agree with the earlier observations of trees versus forest and what disclosures should do. But what I think we are somewhat need to, and that goes back to Scott's earlier comment about an auditing framework as contrasted with the accounting framework. So accounting framework is one issue, and interestingly enough, when Larry mentioned earlier the ITAC comment letter and suggestion for the disclosure framework, which Lynn and myself were intimately involved with through the ITAC, and one of the areas that actually triggered that was exactly the pension disclosures that you get 10 or 15 pages of pension disclosures around FAS 138 or any successor that's highly granular. And then you look at a company that may not be the most significant element. You still get the 15 pages, but you have no idea what assumptions and estimates are built into the return provisions, warranty provisions. It could be much more significant to a user than the pension. And the same goes to IOs under FAS 140 and other elements. You can get pages and pages, but then you step back and say, however, this is not the largest risk, and there may be many things on those financial statements that smell the same, feel the same, but you don't get the same level of disclosure. So what I encourage the accounting framework to think about is, do you apply equal weight, and under what circumstances and why, and could you instill some conceptual rhyme and reason to this analogy? Which takes me to the auditing discussion, which I thought is the topic of today's discussion, and I just jotted down a few elements, and I think we're talking about disclosures, and sometimes it's muddy, the discussion, and I just kind of broke disclosures to their elements. And in my view of disclosure, I may have been missing some elements. There are a few elements in disclosures, and each one can call to different auditing techniques. It's simply the tools or techniques that could be used to audit those. And this clearly falls within could be a conceptual framework to auditing of disclosure that I will distinguish from the conceptual framework to manufacturer disclosures. And what I wrote down here is, first in disclosure, what we normally found is simply replacements for number in the financial statements. So the financial statements say stock-based compensation is going to be reported based on X, and in the footnotes you report based on Y. So if those are substitutional numbers, fair value versus historical cost, the same notion, and it shouldn't be a second-class citizen, as was mentioned earlier, the same technique should apply. Then there are some explanation of simply numbers. This could be roll-forward schedules or some breakdown or some breakdown of numbers. I would think, again, I haven't been auditing but for a long period of time, but I think you apply the same auditing technique to those sub-numbers because all they are sub-numbers. The third element is explanatory language of amounts. Those are generally explaining the numbers in the financial statements. There should be some framework applied to how auditors need to think about this explanatory language. Then there's another element that speaks to estimates and assumptions. What are the estimates and assumptions that underpin the financial statement information? You should apply another audit techniques to that. And the last item on my list is some elements of forward-looking statements that has some notion of MD&A and some other things, but some of it finds its way into financial statement disclosure, including the notion of going concern that was discussed here earlier. So I think if you go through this listing, you simply apply different audit techniques. You make clear what audit techniques are. You see what fits a particular circumstance under you, some conceptual framework, and you provide the auditors with some guidance that can be monitored. I think discussing the disclosures and painting them in broad brush sometimes muddy those elements. So I would encourage you to kind of dissect disclosure to their element rather than addressing them as a single reference.
Sam Renzillo.
Well, Neri, I think you did that without taking a breath. well, let me try to let me just try a couple catch up on a couple of things. First, this IAASB discussion paper, I think, is a really good piece of work, and I think it'll be a significant loss, a missed opportunity on the part of this board if it doesn't actively get involved in that process, because I think that it is asking all the right questions around disclosure and the auditor's involvement around those disclosures. Second piece, I'm going to take exception to a couple of comments that were made by some of the members with respect to that the disclosures of public company, that the audits of disclosures of public companies are been delegated down to our junior people. That is absolutely not true in my experience. I will agree with you that the somewhere between 50 and 150 page disclosure checklist, that the first shot at that is a younger person, a senior accountant, but the majority of the time spent on the most significant elements of the disclosures is by the most senior members of the team, and that includes the engagement quality reviewer, the lead audit partner, and the manager on the account. So I don't want, at least from my experience, to say that disclosures have been delegated down to young people the same way that bank reconciliations and the testing of those are done by younger people. I think that is a misstatement of the current state of the auditing profession. I'll try to respond to Larry Smith's comment, and I don't know which group this was. Are these people that prepare financial statements for that are public companies?
No, these are not-for-profit, primarily not-for-profits.
Okay, well, I'm not familiar with it, but I would suggest that maybe the information that is being, that the auditors are telling them not to include is one of two things. One, it's not auditable, and therefore it's not appropriate to include in financial statements. Or two, maybe it's not supportable and ought not to be disclosed as well. But I'm not aware that auditors are keeping public companies from providing disclosures. Maybe somebody has a view on that, but it's not my experience. The last thing, I'll try to respond to the first question. I think this is sort of going to put me in the category of the master of the obvious, but what are the challenges in auditing? The challenges in auditing disclosures are not around completeness in terms of line item by line item, going through the 50 to 150 pages. Those are not the challenges in auditing disclosures. The challenges, in my view, around auditing disclosures are really in two buckets. The first is the quality and the understandability of the subjective disclosures. And those are the ones that are primarily around what risks and what measurement uncertainty is left in the financial statements after the preparer has done its work and the auditor has done their work. There's still significant measurement uncertainty, and a lot of the disclosures that both the SEC and the FASB require are an attempt for management to provide that information to the users of the financial statements. And I think those are clearly the most difficult ones for us to audit. The second one is sort of a materiality test. So an entity makes a disclosure that you want, one of two situations. A disclosure is made that is, in the view of the auditor, inadequate, or a disclosure is omitted that an auditor believes ought to be included in there. And I think a real challenge that we have is when we look at that and we accumulate that information, does that cause the financial statements to be materially misstated, taken as a whole, which is the ultimate test that the auditor has to reach in order to conclude and issue an unqualified auditor's report. And I think those are the two areas that auditors, when they go through disclosures, those are the two biggest challenges that they have.
Thanks for those comments, and maybe the latter one can be helped with our next project we're going to talk about the auditor's report and enabling the auditor to talk more about the quality of the financial statements. So that's a possible benefit of that project on that second problem you pointed out. But thanks for that input, Sam.
Diana Hillier.
Thank you. I won't repeat what others have said about IAASB's disclosure project. I do thank those who have complimented the discussion paper, and we certainly are looking forward to a very active and lively debate. I did just want to reflect on a couple of things, because I think it's themes that have come out in a number of the discussions today. One of the objectives in that discussion paper, and part of the reason for asking the questions to investors, preparers, regulators, and others, was when we were reaching out and doing liaison meetings last year and talking to people, we kept hearing that auditors aren't necessarily doing the job they were expected to be doing with respect to disclosures. But the underlying reasons that we were heard were diametrically opposed and often conflicting. And it suggests that we do need to be engaging with the preparers, the accounting standard setters, the regulators, and others to discuss these issues, to get a consensus view about how we address them. How do we apply materiality? What is a misstatement in a disclosure? How do we evaluate it? What constitutes sufficient appropriate evidence in some areas? Are there some disclosures that aren't auditable? We tried to put that one on the back burner, but it just kept coming back, and there were different views on that issue. So the need to be talking about that in that multi-stakeholder environment seems to us to be very important in finding practical additional guidance for auditors, because they aren't just audit issues. A lot of them are preparer and regulatory issues as well. The other issue, and I think it was coming up a little bit, but I was reflecting earlier this week, the Financial Stability Board issued their peer review of risk disclosure practices. And it speaks, I think, a little bit to the boundaries of financial statements and the fact that they are getting a little bit blurred, because they were talking about the fact that these risk disclosures may exist in the notes to the financial statements. They may be in MD&A. They may be in the Pillar 3 disclosures. But the question they came out and asked was, what is the auditor's involvement? Should there not be an equivalent level of assurance respect to all of those risk disclosures, no matter where they are? And they challenged the IAASB to think about that and come up with some recommendations on how auditor involvement might be involved. But I think it does speak to this issue that the boundaries of the financial statements are blurring with some of these information that run across some of these various ways that it gets disclosed. So another aspect to think about in respect to disclosures.
Okay, we have three tent cards up, so we'll try and go through those and then close out this topic. Lynn Turner.
We've been auditing footnotes as a profession for a number of years. And so from that perspective, especially given since those footnotes have been complex for quite some period of time, we've had derivatives around for 3 decades, we've had off-balance sheet transactions for 3 decades, we've had a couple of great decades of financial engineering. It's not like as if this is brand new stuff and a rocket scientist. What I'm hearing here is that at least some people think there's just not enough time and perhaps not enough expertise devoted to auditing the footnotes. And my experience was the same as Sam's. The disclosure checklist did start with the junior people, quite frankly, but on the significant items, a partner did go through and get involved, probably the concurring partner as well. However, given the lack of adequate disclosures here, especially with respect to related party transactions, off-balance sheets, risk and uncertainties, it does seriously call into question why those disclosures didn't get made. And I think the bigger issue here is not the issue of where we got too many disclosure, because investors can use electronic tools to get through this stuff and do these days anyway. The issues, the problems have been the fact that there wasn't a disclosure made that was a material disclosure that should have been made to prevent the financial statements from being misleading. And the SEC, both in the 33 and 34 Act rules, have had a rule on their books going back to the 60s saying very clearly that if you need to make a disclosure to prevent the financials from being misleading, it needed to be made. Unfortunately, the FASB doesn't have anything similar to that. Given the response Neary got on the FASB's willingness to really move through the disclosure project, my guess is Neary will be retired by the time we get that done. I certainly wouldn't wait for the FASB project. I think this is something the PCAOB should go ahead and move on. The need to audit footnotes aren't going to wait for the FASB to finally get something done, and God knows it's taken them long enough to redo leases. We're talking about leases when we knew there was a problem in 75, so I'd urge you to go ahead. But I do think the issue isn't auditing disclosures or how the things that get disclosed. The issue is, why was it that something wasn't disclosed that should have been disclosed, and are the auditors looking for those type of things and ensuring somehow that they get made? Because that's where they get in trouble. That's where the investors suffer the losses. And so I'd certainly, as you write it, devote whatever you're going to work on, a significant portion of it to that focus, in addition to making sure that whatever is in there is accurate, correct as well, and complete.
Yeah, to your point, did investors really understand the nature of off-balance sheet exposures, even though there were requirements for disclosures there? Or did they really understand the nature of concentrations of credit risk, even though there were certain dangerous concentrations of credit risk, so on and so forth? And that's why we have this question here, and I suspect that's why the IWSB has its paper as well, to explore these issues. So thanks for those comments, Lynn. And next is
Damon Silver.
Yeah, I want to pick up where Lynn left off, but also just an observation. I mean, we closed before lunch, and we heard that at least some folks thought that really we shouldn't be looking to the numbers in the financial statement to tell us, for example, about impaired assets, that was too much to ask. And I got the feeling that now we were hearing that while we wouldn't look to the numbers in the financial statement for meaningful information, we're also not looking to the narratives for meaningful information. So I began to wonder whether I'd missed something. I was in the wrong room or the wrong meeting. And I was very grateful to Sam Ranzilla, who I thought made clear that, no, in fact, we actually are looking for meaningful information here, and that's well understood by auditors as well as by investors. I think what Lynn said about this is, of course, the obvious truth, that as long as there have been audited financial statements, there have been words as well as numbers, and that those words are necessary in order to make the financial statement what the auditor's opinion letter says it is, and that as a consequence, you cannot audit a financial statement without auditing the words as well as the numbers. I think everybody knows that. So why are we having this conversation the way we're having it? And I think there's something very deeply troubling about it, and this is what I think it is. I think the general drift of what has occurred in relationship to public company auditing as a result of the financial crisis is very different from what occurred, and I'm now old enough and have been around long enough to remember all of this quite clearly, is very different from what occurred in the aftermath of Enron and WorldCom and the events that brought this body, the PCAOB, into being. And it's very sadly different, I think. I think after the Enron and WorldCom episode, there was a feeling that there had been a serious collapse in a set of institutions and arrangements and in a profession that we had relied upon to ensure the fair and efficient workings of our capital markets, and that therefore we were going to do something about it. And I think that feeling was fairly widespread, although obviously people disagreed about what exactly was going to be done. I think that feeling was fairly widespread, that it was a big and important problem that the system of public company financial disclosure and the auditing thereof had failed, and that the profession of public auditing had failed, and that things had to be done. And one of the reasons why, and that one of the things that was done was this body was created. And I remember the environment that attended the initial meetings of this body, the SAG, and it was an environment in which that was considered a very serious problem, a problem which in certain respects unified particularly auditors and investors around the need to do something. Now, I think sadly enough, and I hope that this is not a permanent feature of our political process, but I think at the moment what has happened in relationship to public to auditing, to public accounting and to auditing as a result of the events of the last couple of years has been that the process is effectively becoming irrelevant. And that the and that the aftermath, now that the Dow is sort of kind of around 12,000 again, and now that various bodies without benefit of any real hard data pronounce various institutions to be sound, now everyone's fat and happy again, or at least everyone who's in the interstices of the financial system. I won't speak to the 15 million unemployed or the 13 million people facing the loss of their homes, or the people who pay my salaries and what they are facing in this country right now. But a certain portion of us are all fat and happy. That the general conclusion here is very similar to the kind of environment that we had in 2005 and 2006 and 2007, it's not the deregulatory agenda of 2005 and 2006 and 2007. It's the agenda of irrelevancy. It's the agenda that we're just going to push all of these processes off the stage. And somehow we don't need them. I think that is what is going on here. And I think the other side of the coin is that they are just simply too dangerous. That we have told ourselves a series of lies about our financial system and our economy. We are living fat and happy on those lies temporarily for now. And in a financial accounting system and auditing system that actually functioned would make it impossible to indulge in those lies. Now that's an awful lot to put, that's an awful lot of burden to put on this particular subject, but I think once you start asking the question of why are people suggesting that it doesn't really matter, that neither the numbers nor the text mean anything, that it's got to have a deeper meaning than simply the usual kind of go-round that occurs in Washington. So I'll leave you all with that.
Chairman Doty, I think you have a comment.
Well, I'm stimulated by that. I agree with the historiography as far as it goes, and I'm challenged by the conclusion. I think first, I do think that what brought this board into being and the collapse that we saw, or the crisis, the scandal we saw at the time of Enron was fundamentally different. It was a Main Street scandal. And auditing has been deeply involved in Main Street, in the reporting of Main Street, and the fact that the board comes in to history the way it does is absolutely understandable. I think the second scandal, though, Damon, is I'm a big fan of Robert Samuelson, and I think he was right when he said what we had was the failure of a financial system that had been accorded validity because it had the responsibility for allocating capital. It told us when a company that said it needed $5 million was entitled validly to go to the public and raise $5 million because then the underwriting system had looked at what it planned to do with it. It looked at the management they had in place, the business plan. It decided that they, in fact, could spend the $5 million properly. That's what failed. And what happened was that Wall Street, for reasons that are amply described in all the different books that we've been reading, ceased to perform that fundamental function. It's a function John Whitehead wrote about and talked about informing Goldman Sachs in the beginning, and we all know that. What we're seeing, I think, is not an admission of irrelevance or paralysis in the face of this. And on the contrary, I think what all of this is about is recognition that auditing and the board are in a new phase, that this is phase two for the board. It is post-Welltech. It's post many things for the auditing profession, post-Welltech, post-Penn Central, post-you name it, certainly post-Enron. And we're now post the financial crisis, and therefore, how do we make auditing come to grips with exactly what people are wrestling with here, which is the non-quantitative aspects of full and fair financial disclosure. I don't have any doubt that the members of the Standing Advisory Group have articulated the ways in which that can be achieved. I do think that that from Denny and FASB on down to this end of the table, there have been many good ideas put out on how it can be achieved. I have no doubt that there will be change, that what you're seeing is a recognition around the table that what the vehicle will be, what the rules are going to be, and how the change is going to be articulated is yet to be clear. But I don't think there's any doubt that the audit profession is fully capable of dealing with the challenges presented when a financial system betrays us, when a financial model collapses. I mean, this is the collapse of a kind of financing model. Steve and I argue all the time about whether Europe is ahead of us or we're ahead of Europe. I happen to think we're ahead of Europe. It's an interesting argument to keep tabs of, but it's a good moment, I think, to transition to Steve. I don't want to presume on the chairman's on the chief auditor's function here, but I do think we're about to get our teeth into this question of where the disclosures ought to be, what the rules ought to be that drive the disclosures. So I think you should sleep well tonight, Damon, because there's no abdication in the room. There's no sense of abdication.
I'm pleased to hear that. I will sleep well.
And thanks for those comments. And Arnie, the last word on this subject is we're going to take a short break afterwards for our final discussion.
So this is two or three times now. I've had the last word.
You are the man.
I'll tell you.
So set it up this way intentionally.
Well, I've listened to all this dialogue, and none of my colleagues around the table who are preparers have jumped in on this thing. But, you know, we're the ones that have responsibility for the financial statements. They are our financial statements. We're the ones that are responsible for the developing and writing the footnotes and the appropriate disclosures. It's not the auditor's responsibility to write our footnotes for us. And I think we've lost sight of all that. And so we preparers, or at least my perspective as a preparer, is that I have a primary responsibility to make sure that my financial statements are in accordance with GAAP and they follow all the appropriate disclosures. At least my personal experience is that the checklists start out in my staff. We take the checklist. We put together packages to document the footnotes, and included in that package is the checklist that ENY uses. And we have to go through, and my staff knows that they have to indicate in that checklist whether or not they've covered the disclosure, and if they haven't, why they haven't, and if it's material or not material. Then it goes to the ENY auditors for review. And it's not given necessarily to a junior staff person. It's given, it ultimately gets up to a manager, senior manager, or partner. And then we engage in some reasonable dialogue and some healthy tension at times if they take exception to some of the disclosures. And then we get resolution. And then ultimately the SEC has some oversight. And trust me, we've all received SEC letters on our disclosures over the years. And then you engage in dialogue with them. So I think what we're trying to do here, I'm not sure what problem we're trying to solve, but we ought to try to get to the root cause of the problem, but I'm not sure it lands on the heels of the auditors. Preparers have the ultimate responsibility, not the auditors. So with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Well, difficult to articulate the problem, but I think it's been said around the table that, to some extent, many have felt that disclosures haven't been adequate. To Judge Friendly's point, that they need to sometimes go beyond GAAP and say what has to be reported in order for those financial statements to present fairly. So we think it's an important topic in terms of, obviously, we know it's the preparer's responsibility, but that auditors do an appropriate job of auditing disclosures. We think we've improved that framework in the risk assessment standards. We're going to continue to look at it. We're looking at the IAASB paper as well, and we'll talk some more about this in future subjects. Thanks, everybody, for a very lively dialogue around the auditing disclosures. We're a bit behind schedule. We do want to give some additional time to the auditor's reporting model. As I said, this is the last chance we have to get input from you all before we put together our concept release. So can I ask you to take about a 10-minute break, get a refreshment, and get back here in about 10 minutes, and we'll get onto that topic. Thank you.